constitutional crisis looming as thousands across Israel fill the streets in protest of a parliamentary vote to limit the powers of its courts.
I think that the fear is a true and honest to God constitutional crisis. And that is a very, very dangerous thing for any country, but particularly one like Israel, where the divisions run so, so, so deep.
Plus, as Russia bombards Ukraine's southern port cities, the UN chief urges Moscow to revive a deal critical to addressing a global food crisis.
I call on the Russian Federation to return to the implementation of the Black Sea Initiative in line with my latest proposal.
And the region that's close to becoming the first place in the world to reach the UN's target for ending transmission of HIV. Today is Tuesday, July 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Lori London in Washington. Israel's parliament on Monday approved the first major law in Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's contentious plan to limit the country's justice system, triggering a new burst of mass protests across the country and drawing accusations that he was pushing the country toward authoritarian rule. Demonstrators chained themselves to posts and blocked the road outside parliament over the move that raised the heat on a constitutional crisis brewing in the country for months. U.S. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller reiterated the Biden administration's longstanding concerns, calling the vote unfortunate.
With respect to the vote in the Knesset today, as we've said before, as a lifelong friend of Israel, President Biden has publicly and privately expressed his views that major changes in a democracy should be, if they're going to be enduring, must have as broad a consensus as possible. It was unfortunate that the vote today took place with the slimmest possible majority. We understand talks are ongoing and likely to continue over the coming weeks and months to forge a broader compromise, even with the Knesset in recess, and we will continue to support the efforts of President Herzog and other Israeli leaders as they seek to build a broader consensus through political dialogue.
As Netanyahu's allies celebrated their victory and vowed to press ahead with more changes, opponents said they would challenge the new law in the Supreme Court. For What's Next, I spoke with Elisheva Goldberg, Senior Media and Policy Director with the New Israel Fund.
There was a constitutional law professor that predicted the law would be appealed to the Supreme Court. And that struck me, that if they're making a law to take away some of the power of the Supreme Court, then if it's appealed to the Supreme Court, where does it go? What happens?
I mean, that's sort of par excellence the definition of a constitutional crisis. Who has the power in that scenario to determine what happens? And I think that the great fear is that if that happens, every Israeli will choose sides and the army will be split. You know, there's like, in some sense, there's a class split in the army also, and in Israel, that's also happening here, which is that the elite, the people who are well off, the people for whom, you know, the country with the judiciary, you know, has served them, they want this to continue. And people who feel that the country has not served them, and that the judiciary is actually out to get them, and that the judiciary doesn't uphold their rights. And I'm talking about, you know, the ultra-Orthodox, and I'm talking about the settler movement. They feel that the judiciary has stood against them. Those people would like to see this go through. And so there's a real potential for a tear, what people are calling a tear in the nation. And when I say tear in the nation, I also should specify that's the Jewish nation. I think that, you know, there's a whole nother conversation to be had about the Arab citizens of Israel and their participation in these protests, or their sense of what it means to be a democracy, even before we were talking about, you know, the judiciary and whether Israel was really serving them as full citizens in for the last years of its existence, especially the last 10 or 15. So that's its own kettle of fish. But I think that the fear is a true and honest and, you know, an honest to God constitutional crisis. And that is a very, very dangerous thing for any country, but particularly one like Israel, where the divisions run so, so, so deep.
Elisheva Goldberg, Senior Media and Policy Director with the New Israel Fund. The Biden administration announced Monday it's sending up to $400 million in additional military aid to Ukraine, including a variety of munitions for advanced air defense systems and a number of small surveillance Hornet drones as attacks in the war escalate. Monday, Russia accused Kyiv of terrorism, saying that two Ukrainian drones had damaged buildings in Moscow, while its military unleashed drone strikes in southern Ukraine. Associated Press correspondent Karen Shamis reports.
Moscow says one of the drones fell near the defense ministry's main headquarters, striking two non-residential buildings. No one was apparently hurt. Ukrainian authorities didn't immediately claim responsibility for the strike, which was the second drone attack on the Russian capital this month. Meanwhile, Russian forces targeted port infrastructure on the Danube River in southern Ukraine, which included a grain hangar and storage for other cargo. The Ukrainian military confirmed it struck three of the attacking drones. I'm Karen Chamas.
As Russia bombards Ukraine's ports, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling on Moscow to revive a deal with Ukraine that would allow grain shipments to resume, warning otherwise the most vulnerable will suffer.
The Russian Federation and Ukraine are both essential to global food security. They have historically accounted for roughly 30% of global wheat and barley exports, a fifth of all maize, and more than half of all sunflower oil.
Since Russia quit the deal and began attacking Ukrainian food exporting ports on the Black Sea and Danube River, global wheat and corn futures have risen sharply. Wildfires raging in Greece continued to force thousands of tourists and residents to flee the island of Rhodes Monday as flames threatened resorts and coastal villages. Officials say the threat of further fires is high in almost every region of the country. From Reuters, Joel Flynn reports.
Paradise on fire. Forests on the Greek island getaway of Rhodes blazed through the night on Sunday, leaving the sky glowing orange. Drone footage showed wildfires raising acres of ground in a disaster that has forced the evacuation of tens of thousands of tourists and locals. The Agros International Airport was seen earlier in the day crammed with people, many sleeping while they waited for news of rescue. Rhodes is a hugely popular holiday destination, particularly with visitors from Britain. Tourists told Reuters about the, quote, chaos that they'd witnessed.
Basically, you could see the fire eventually on the mountaintop. Panic, everyone dashing about, fleeing for buses.
I don't know how many tourists there are in Faliroki, but evacuating that area, it's going to be impossible.
Others had talked about walking for miles in scorching heat to reach safety, with footage from Saturday showing scores of people walking across beaches. Thousands reportedly also had to spend the night here and in the streets. Greece said the operation to get people to safety was the biggest of its kind in emergency conditions. The Greek Transport Ministry said TUI and Jet2, which handle the bulk of tourism to Rhodes, planned 14 scheduled flights from Rhodes Airport, transferring around 2,700 passengers until 3 a.m. local time. Satellite images of Rhodes before and after the fires showed the extent of the blazes and the destruction they have wrought. Aerial footage released by the Turkish Ministry of Agriculture and Forestry showed aircraft helping fight the fires. Fires are common in Greece, but climate change has led to more extreme heat waves across southern Europe and many other parts of the world. Temperatures over the past week have exceeded 104 degrees Fahrenheit in many parts of Greece. In addition to Rhodes, emergency services were dealing with fires across a series of other locations in Greece. Despite the evacuations, one government official said the fires on the island had largely been contained.
Joel Flynn with Reuters reporting. In a showdown over immigration policies, the United States Justice Department has filed a lawsuit against the governor of Texas for his refusal to remove a barrier from the Rio Grande River. We hear more now from Associated Press correspondent Jackie Quinn.
The lawsuit was coming. The Justice Department told Texas Governor Greg Abbott last week it would take legal action if he didn't remove a string of giant orange buoys from the Rio Grande, aimed at blocking migrants from crossing the river. The governor said, "See you in court." White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says the Justice Department is doing just that.
They also will see Governor Abbott in court for his unlawful actions.
What makes it illegal?
Making it difficult to access the river, patrol the area.
There were also environmental concerns and complaints about other anti-migrant efforts. But Governor Abbott, in a letter to the president, says he has the right to defend his state's borders. I'm Jackie Quinn.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Heavy casualties have been reported after a suicide bomber detonated an explosive vest at a military academy in Mogadishu early Monday. The Al-Shabaab militant group immediately claimed responsibility for the attack. The American-led UN command said it has started a conversation with North Korea about a U.S. soldier who ran into the North last week, crossing one of the world's most heavily fortified borders. And Elon Musk has unveiled a new black and white X logo to replace Twitter's famous blue bird as he follows through on a major rebranding of the social media platform he bought for $44 million last year. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Critical materials, which include rare earth elements, are important in the manufacture of consumer and non-commercial goods and in the development of green energy initiatives. But the U.S. and other countries must import most of these materials from outside sources to maintain a sufficient supply. Researchers at Penn State University are looking into ways of using waste materials from Pennsylvania's many coal mines as a new source of these valuable materials. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, Pennsylvania is the second largest exporter of coal in the United States. An important secondary benefit of using this waste would be to reduce environmental pollution. Penn State is heading a group that will evaluate and list key mineral resources in and outside of Pennsylvania. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Millions of Sudanese have fled the capital city, Khartoum, since fighting between rival generals began on April 15th. Many of them have fled to Otbarat, northeast of Khartoum. Sidimet Ibrahim visited the city and has this story from Otbarat, Sudan, narrated by VOA's Salem Solomon.
The city of Atbara is about 350 kilometers northeast of Sudan's capital, Khartoum. Today, Atbara is hosting people from Khartoum and elsewhere who've been displaced by the fighting between two rival generals that began in April. Some refugees choose to stay in Atbara and others use it as transit hub to Port Sudan or the neighboring country of Egypt. Community members like Yusuf Hassan have set up an emergency station that provides shelter and other basic needs.
We focused on the issue of providing housing for the displaced, and we were able to house a large number of people fleeing the hell of the Khartoum war in the city of Atbara. They were housed in schools, homes, and guest houses, and the number of shelter centers in Atbara has reached 45 since beginning of the war.
Hassan says most of the work is done by volunteers like himself.
We work without receiving any government assistance. Most of the aid comes to us from philanthropists and the youth from neighborhoods active in volunteer work.
The volunteers say they are facing supply shortages. The UN says that as of July 14, more than 3 million people have been displaced because of the conflict, including 2.4 million within Sudan. Sharaf Al-Wad fled Khartoum and says the people in Atbara have been welcoming.
When we arrived to Atbara, people was very, the hospitality of people of Atbara was great. They received us. We stayed at houses, places. They provide us food, accommodation, and all the necessary requirements that for our own safety. But we still have a lot of gaps that need to be filled in medication, in food supply, in accommodation also.
Despite the difficulties Atbara faces in providing adequate support, it continues to host refugees. But activists say they need help and are appealing to international and other organizations for aid. For Saeed Ahmed Ibrahim in Atbara, Sudan, Salem Solomon, VOA News.
Researchers say the central districts in Sydney are close to becoming the first place in the world to reach the UN's target for ending transmission of HIV. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has the story.
At first, only gays and IV drug users were being killed by AIDS. But now we know every one of us could be devastated by it.
In 1987, the Grim Reaper advert warned Australians about the march of a deadly virus. HIV attacks the body's immune system, and if not treated, can lead to AIDS. In the central parts of Sydney, Australia's biggest city, thousands of gay men died in the 1980s and 90s. In a remarkable turnaround, Researchers say that only 11 new HIV cases were recorded in central Sydney last year. Almost all HIV-positive people in Australia are on retroviral drugs. They suppress the level of the virus in the blood, reducing the risk of sexual transmission. There's also the use of pre-exposure prophylaxis, preventative medicines taken by people who don't have HIV to lower their chance of infection. Gay men make up about 20% of the male population in inner Sydney, and they represent most of the city's HIV cases. The research confirming the change in HIV rates in Sydney was presented to the International AIDS Society's HIV Science Conference, being held in the Queensland city of Brisbane by Andrew Grulick, an epidemiologist at the University of New South Wales. He told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's 7:30 programme earlier this month that he's seen HIV gradually being conquered over his academic career.
My life in research has been over that period, so it's been terrible and it's been extraordinary, and now it's getting close to wonderful, really.
However, rates of infection have fallen by only a third in some outer Sydney suburbs, where public health awareness, access to medical treatments and testing new cases are more limited. Jane Costello, the Chief Executive Officer of Positive Life, an organisation that helps people living with HIV, told VOA about some groups still being left behind.
Overseas-born men who have sex with men, heterosexual populations, people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So it is a question of equity as well.
The AIDS conference in Brisbane has heard that parts of the United Kingdom and Western Europe have also seen rapid drops in new HIV cases, but few places, if any, can rival Sydney's fall in infections of almost 90% over the past decade. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A class that teaches teenage girls how to code or write instructions for computers is drawing a lot of interest in Mongolia. For VOA, Graham Canwit and Elizabeth Lee have the story about a program that prepares them for jobs in technology.
Coding, community, and careers. All things that Ballora Erding Botsingle hopes to provide through Girls Code. Botsingle started the program during the pandemic to provide education and computer programming for 16 to 18-year-old girls in Mongolia.
One of the things, not only in Mongolia, but worldwide, realized is the digital inclusion issues, and we use technology to really fill the gaps and really to survive.
Despite being sparsely populated, Mongolia has broad internet access. However, Botsingle says, education in computer science and information and communications technology, or ICT, for girls is lacking.
The STEM education for girls, especially in the nomadic community, has not been very well delivered. So we wanted to ensure that the girls have options to pursue.
Gandhi Surad, a Girls Code graduate, says that the program taught her coding fundamentals for classes at New York University, Shanghai.
The things that I learned in the program really made it easier to learn in college because, you know, the logic, fundamental logic behind every coding language is there are really similar.
Girls Code also aims to keep Mongolia on the cutting edge of technological development.
One of the reasons I started this program is that for Mongolia, which has only 3.4 million population, sandwiched between two giant big countries, Russia and China, it gives us a lot of opportunities to use technology to fill the lack of human capital we have.
Botsingle says that this education is aimed more at unlocking Mongolia's potential than competition.
Rather than competing with China or the US, I think Mongolia has potential to contribute to the tech world.
Many Girls Code graduates choose to continue their education.
When I say I hope to work in the US, I think it's for like 3 to 5 years for me to just get the experience and what it is like in the best technology companies in the world, bring back the education and the things that I learned back in my home country.
Surad hopes to pursue a career in data science. Graham Canwit for VOA News, Washington.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, video, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is an El Niño year. Normal weather patterns in the eastern Pacific Ocean are disrupted by a warming of surface waters. El Niño occurs usually every 2 to 10 years and impacts weather conditions around the globe. Typically, within El Niño, you will see global reductions in economic growth and country-level impacts that can actually persist for years, said the U.S. State Department's Special Envoy for Global Food Insecurity, Carrie Fowler. You also typically see global declines in production of some of the major staple crops, wheat, rice, maize.
We're already seeing declines in fish harvest off the coast of Peru, and in fact, just recently, Peru announced that it was suspending the anchovy harvest there for the first season. The last time they did that was the previous El Niño, 2014-15.
That's important, noted Special Envoy Fowler, because anchovies are a main ingredient in many animal feeds and fish meal. He said that fewer anchovy harvests in the early 1970s led to higher grain prices and a global food crisis. And he stressed that from a food security standpoint, the United States is keeping a particularly close, watchful eye on Southern Africa, on Central America, and Southeast Asia. El Niño is also correlated with an uptick in conflict, warned Special Envoy Fowler.
It's a threat multiplier, doubling the chances of conflict in Africa and playing a significant role in over 20% of the conflicts there since 1950.
We can't change the weather overnight, but the State Department has been the catalyst for a number of programs which are directly related to how the world is going to be responding to this El Niño and future El Niños, said Special Envoy Fowler. Programs such as Adapted Crops and Soils, which explores how traditional and indigenous crops in Africa will do in a climate-changed world, and USAID's program in Africa that's bringing drought-tolerant maize, for example, to millions of farms across Southern Africa. Working through the Department of State, Special Envoy Fowler noted, the United States government is partnering with the African Union and the UN Food and Agricultural Organization to bring more attention and more investment to the traditional and indigenous crops starting in Africa. The fundamentals for food security, stressed Special Envoy Fowler, are healthy, fertile soils and crops adapted to both the weather and to market conditions.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.